Agenda item number 7, report and possible discussion on Brazos River freshwater mussel candidate species update by Tiffany Morgan, Environmental Service Manager, and Dr. Robert Gully.
I'm just going to give a brief overview for those of you that are new. We have a potential pending endangered species issue in the basin. And then I'm going to introduce Dr. Gully of the Comptroller's Office, which the Comptroller's Office has taken the lead on endangered species issues for the state. And he's going to review their program dealing specifically with this mussels. As some of you remember, we discussed that there are some candidate listed mussels, which means there are on the list to be considered for endangered status under the Federal Endangered Species Act. Right now we have 3 mussels that are being considered that affect our basin, the smooth pimpleback, the Texas fawn's foot, and the false spike. U.S. Fish and Wildlife now has proposed their schedule on these mussels. They are going to begin the process in FY 2017 and have an anticipated decision date sometime in 2018. Listing of any one of these mussels could impact our current and future operations. Just to give you a picture, these are the 3 in question. Smooth pimple back runs about 4-5 inches diameter, fawn's foot about 3 to 4 inches long. So there's small little critters that live down in the mud in the rivers. This is a current map of where we know we have populations of these mussels in our basin. You can see the smooth pimpleback is fairly well distributed throughout the lower basin and the central basin. The false spike is only known to right now to occur in 2 locations on the San Gabriel River in our basin, then 2 locations in the Colorado River. And then fawn's foot is predominantly lower basin. Recently, there has been some surveys in the Navasota, which will greatly expand the coverage of the smooth pimpleback in this area. We just don't have the final report with the actual locations yet. However, I will say the more they find, generally the better that is, because that goes to leading that there's more of them out there than most people thought. Why do we care? Honestly, because the Endangered Species Act is one of the most powerful pieces of environmental legislation out there. It has been widely upheld in federal courts. It's never really been substantially defeated. And reviewing court cases in other states and even previous cases on different mussel or endangered species in this state, they can limit the state's exercise of their water rights. They can restrict or modify new water projects and have done so. And any water use that results in the direct or incidental take or harm of the species. So if during a drought we dry out a mussel bed, that can have some punitive results to us. And generally, the ESA has drawn its strength from the United States Constitution Supremacy Clause, and that's how they get away with trumping state initiatives and state laws. And so now I'd like to introduce Dr. Robert Gully, who is currently the Director of Economic Growth and Endangered Species Management Division of the Texas Comptroller of Public Accounts. Previously, he's been the Executive Director of the Habitat Conservation Program at the Edwards Aquifer Authority. Dr. Gully has a BA and his JD from the University of Texas and his PhD from University of Minnesota. He has over 25 years of experience as an environmental attorney, including 7 years as a senior trial attorney the Justice Department. Thank you, Dr. Bowie.
Despite being a lawyer, I'll try to be fairly brief. In January of 2017, Controller Hager announced a $2.3 million contract with Texas State University to look at 5 candidates for listing by the Fish and Wildlife Service. The program is really very unique in its comprehensiveness, in the state involvement in it. Both the regional director Tuggle for Region 2 of Fish and Wildlife Service and the head of the mussels program have said they've never seen anything like it. And so what I'd like to do is give you a little bit of background about how we decided to make a decision to essentially go all in on the Central Texas mussels and discuss a little bit about the program so that you can see what what's going to be involved. I forgot to add that as part of the program, For the research, we're also going to set up a stakeholder process where the stakeholders will have an opportunity on a real-time basis to get the results of the work and to discuss with other stakeholders possible strategies for dealing with it. Before I begin, I'd like to introduce two people that are with me. One is Megan Hope. If you'll kind of wave your hand a little bit. She is in charge of our research program and has largely been involved in putting together the program I'm going to discuss. And the other is Dr. Tim Bonner. Y'all are quite familiar with him on some of his BBAST work. And he will be the one that will be leading the program. Dr. Bonner is an aquatic biologist with experience both in fish and mussels. And in addition, he is a quantitative ecologist, probably one of the primary people in the state with familiarity with statistical analysis and experimental design. So why is it that the Comptroller's Office decided to make such a large investment, to invest not only $2.3 million, but to have the study include five mussel species in the Brazos, in the Colorado River, and in the upper Guadalupe River? And I think the answer is that because there's a potential serious problem out there. Fish and Wildlife Service has had a predilection to list mussels. There's 75 mussels that are now listed as endangered, 14 that are listed in threatened across the country. There is a feeling among those of us that have been dealing with this for some time that it was just a matter of time before it got to Texas, and it looks like that time has come. As a result of a petition from an environmental group, Fish and Wildlife Service made a decision on the Texas hornshell and has proposed it for listing. It was a decision made in the middle of last year, and the final determination will be made soon. In addition to the hornshell, 11 other species of mussels are due to be considered by the end of FY22, of which 10 of those decisions will occur by 2020. The listing decisions for the Central Texas mussels, Central Texas mussels, will occur by September 2018, and the final decisions on the remaining species by 2020. We don't know what the results of those studies will be, of those determinations will be. But if the Texas hornshell is any example, I think there is a reasonable likelihood that some, if not many, of these species could be listed. The Texas hornshell was a species in the Rio Grande, found all the way from New Mexico to Brownsville. There were three very relatively significant populations. And nonetheless, Fish and Wildlife Service made the determination to list, determination to list the species. When they did so, they focused on two big issues. First is water quantity. They looked at surface water flows. They looked at surface water flows. And making sure that the flows were adequate to protect the mussels. They looked at groundwater usage and its impact on those surface water flows, and they really focused heavily on dams and reservoirs as being threats and impediment to the survival of the species. They also focused on water quality. They were very concerned about salinity, ammonia, and sedimentation. Now, based on all of this, we decided that we had to go large on this program. The one thing is that Comptroller Hager, when he came into office and first asked me to set up the program that deals with endangered species, is a strong believer in the best way to minimize the impacts of the endangered species is the development of good science. Fish and Wildlife Service is required to make their listing determinations on the best available science. And that means whatever happens to be available at the time. There's one species that the last piece of science that they're considering is 10 years old. I can tell you from experience that it doesn't matter what the decision is as to whether to list or not list that species. Anything that's based on 10-year-old science is not going to be a good decision. So we're trying to focus on trying to develop good science with the belief that if we can get good science in front of the agency, we perhaps can keep the species from being listed. We were successful in that in one effort involving the Sprague's pipit. Or if not, we can minimize the impacts of that listing decision. But the primary reason that I think we're for our concern is the fact that the decisions that are going to be made are not going to be based upon a particular basin or a particular activity, but they're going to be based upon the status of the species as a whole. And as you can see, there are a number of species that overlap between these three watersheds. And the rule is that if they list the species is listed wherever it's found. It doesn't matter whether the species is doing well on the Brazos. If it's sufficient to be listed, then the Brazos is going to be caught up in the problem. And therefore, we felt that it was necessary, if not essential, that we take a comprehensive approach. That is, we try to look at the species, all these species that are in the Central Texas Mussel group, at the same time, and try to make conclusions about the science based upon the totality of the situation. Finally, of course, we recognize the potential impact on the state's economy if mussels are listed. It not only is likely to have economic impact, direct economic impacts, but it has the potential for interfering with the state's management of its own natural resources. And this is a very important decision issue for the controller, and one that guided him collectively with the other items I've mentioned to decide that this is a time to draw a line and let's see what we can do about it. Now, try to catch up with my pages. So, as I said, we put together a program that's large in scope, but we also have made efforts to try to develop a stakeholder process. We intend to have stakeholder meetings on a regular basis, perhaps even as frequently as monthly, in which we'll have an opportunity to discuss the science that's being developed. We can talk about options for dealing with the listing if listing appears to be inevitable. And we can also provide a forum in which stakeholders can share their concerns and their issues and their approaches so that everybody knows what everybody else is thinking. And perhaps at the end of the day, they may decide to undertake some voluntary conservation actions to protect the species to avoid listing, or at least to minimize the impact of listing. We have announced our first meeting will be on February 7th. And it will be a meeting in which we will discuss in detail, and Dr. Bonner will present in detail and answer any questions about the program that we've put together. In addition, Controller Hager will speak, as will Dr. Tuggle from the Regional Director of Fish and Wildlife Service and the person that will make the decision about listing. He's already told us that he's very impressed with the scope and the fact that we're willing to take on a project of this size. And he's also particularly impressed with the fact that it has the imprimatur of the state behind it. He has committed that he will devote the resources of his office to make sure that we get our questions answered, to provide us any additional information we need, and in fact, as I'll discuss in a minute, to actually participate some in the development of the science. So that's the first partnership. The first partnership will be among the stakeholders. The second one was with Fish and Wildlife Service. And finally, we've reached out to Texas Parks and Wildlife, and Ross Melinchuk will talk and talk about TPWD's commitment to the program and willingness to help in any way they can. This meeting, like all our meetings, will be open to the public, and everyone can participate. Now, back up one. Let's talk about what we're doing.
Hey, sir. Yep. Sir.
Yeah.
Where is this meeting going to be held?
This meeting will be held at the Travis Building. It's across the street from the controller's office in Austin. It'll be at 9 o'clock on February 7th, run probably from 9 to 12, but run as long as we need to get everybody's question answered.
Thank you.
Yes.
And who are considered stakeholders?
Anyone that wants to attend, that has an interest. I think it's important that, we get all the input. If we're going to be successful, we'd like to bring as many people on board if we're successful in keeping the species from being listed. And if not, at least we'd like to get everybody's input. My experience, and I mediated 6 years of the Edwards Aquifer dispute, and at the end of the day, there were a lot of people that went along with the decision, not necessarily because they agreed, but because they felt that they had had an opportunity to be heard. So we think the same principle should be useful here. I'm not going to run through a complete list. Dr. Bonner is going to do this at the February 7th meeting. We've provided Tiffany with a little more detailed recitation of the scope of it, of the project. We are going, as most mussel studies do, to do further surveys on the three rivers to make sure that any gaps in information about where the species are and as equally as importantly, where they aren't. But we're also, we're not going to stop there. That's where a lot of the traditional studies do stop. We're also going to do what we call applied research. Now, applied research means is that we're going to try to tackle the question of are some of the believed impacts, do they actually have a negative effect on the species? And if they have a negative effect, what's the range of effect? I mean, not every effect is instantly fatal to the species or necessarily detrimental to the species. And so what we're going to do is go into the laboratory and we're going to try to develop tolerances to issues like flow, some of the qualitative studies, desiccation study. Tiffany told me I'd have to explain that one, and that meant I had to look it up. Desiccation study is really just looking at the response of mussels to drought or to drying up, see how they move, how they behave, and ultimately their survivability under these circumstances. And we're also going to be doing other scientific studies to try to understand the effects better on the mussels. But the one I want to turn your attention to is captive propagation. Captive propagation, I think this is the first time that it's been tried on any large scale in Texas. It has been tried in other places in the country, in the southeast. The idea behind captive propagation is you bring mussels into the laboratory, you learn how to grow them, and then you have the ability to put them back into the wild. And this offers a number of opportunities. It first offers a safety net. That is, that if you have a severe drought, Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't have to have the same degree of concern because we will have a reserve that we can maintain the species once the drought has been relieved. If there needs to be connectivity between populations, you've got a supply of mussels you can bring in. If populations need to be enhanced, you have that ability too. And so this provides, I think, an opportunity for Fish and Wildlife Service to be more realistic about their thinking about listing and more realistic in thinking about the types of requirements that might result through the consultation process. So we will be, and it has the possibility that it can serve as a basis, if not a cornerstone, of any kind of voluntary conservation measures. The idea is if you have a certain amount of conservation that's needed and you can satisfy a lot through captive propagation, then what's left may have less impact. So I think it's a very important program. It will be a program that will be unique in Texas. I can tell you that Dr. Tuggle is extremely enthusiastic about it, and he's committed not only his resources from Region 2, but to get us whatever resources we need from other parts of the country where Fish and Wildlife Service people have done work on this. And so I think his enthusiasm and his buying into it will go a long way to make this particular part of the study successful. Okay, well, what are we trying to do? What's our objective through all of this? Well, we'd like to avoid listing. But if we can't avoid listing, we want to make sure that the impacts of listing are realistic and cost-effective. And we want to provide then options for the stakeholders to consider if listing appears to be inevitable. And so that's what we hope to accomplish by this study, and that's what we hope to use these meetings to try to foster the discussions that are necessary for people to come to become more and more familiar with the options. Because if you leave it to Fish and Wildlife Service, you'll neither find them realistic nor cost-effective. Next slide. Our research team, we've put together what we think is a very effective team. And what we tried to do is rather than try to find one university to conduct all the studies, we tried to get the expertise that was necessary to address the particular problems that we wanted to tackle in the research. I've given you a little bit of background on Dr. Bonner, and I won't make you blush again, but we'll use also BioWest, who will be working in a number of aspects of the problem. They've worked extensively with mussels and surveys, and they're very good at experimental design. Fish and Wildlife Service, part of the commitment that Dr. Tuggle has made is the use of his facilities for the cultivation of mussels and some of the applied research. And he's offered three facilities. One of them is the what they call SMARC, also a facility at Inks Dam on the Colorado River, and the Uvalde hatcheries, where they have the facilities to grow and to conduct the experimentation that's necessary on the species. They will contribute their scientists to the study. And of course, the more they are involved, the more you get buy-in. So it's a practical decision as well as a good decision. In addition, we're bringing in Dr. Jim Stokel from Auburn University. Jim Stokel has been responsible for developing approaches and techniques for the applied research. He runs a laboratory at Auburn. If some of y'all are Aggie fans like I can, maybe you can get it like I am, maybe you can get over it. But nonetheless, he's really good at what he does. He brings a lot of expertise and obviously is going to be able to provide us a lot of help in that regard. Next slide, please. Finally, just to kind of talk a little, just again, and reiterate in terms of the stakeholder engagement. We intend to set up a public website. I talked to Dr. Bonner on the way up here today. It'll be a website that'll be accessible. And I don't know what real time means in this context, but as fast as they can get it out and online, it'll be available to all the stakeholders so that rather than have to wait for a meeting or wait until the research is done, you all can get it in real time and begin to factor that into your own internal thinking. We'll use the stakeholder meetings, as I've said, to talk about those results and to consider options for voluntary conservation measures. Kind of rushed through it. Are there any questions y'all would like to ask me? Yes, sir.
Who's initiating the study that you're responding to? Where did it come from?
It came from my office.
I'm sorry?
It came from my office.
His office.
We obviously, freshwater mussels were an issue, and we were the one that tried to, we stepped in and tried to decide how big a program and what kind of program we needed to be able to tackle this first major listing decision. Yes.
People and the things that you're gonna tackle, it didn't show to me that what's the economic impact of a listing and who will be working on that, especially in the section where you have the different types of voluntary conservation activities. You know, what is it gonna cost? Why do we have to have it in certain areas? What's gonna happen if something is listed? What happens to that waterway? Is that going to prevent all types of economic development? That kind of thing. I didn't see anything that showed.
I think our objective there is that will be part of the stakeholder process. And to the extent that we need outside expertise, mm-hmm. certainly the economic impact is something that the controller's office is well suited to do. Yes. But we'll bring in whatever experts that are necessary to discuss the very questions that you've asked. Does that help you a little bit on thinking?
It does. I hadn't heard of this particular thing, and I keep up with a lot of stuff. And I was wondering are you at least making it available to the stakeholders that are in industry that might be really affected by the activities that you have? I know recreational people will be affected because of if you had a boat out there and that boat was going around with mussels on it, you would have some regulations on boating, but I mean, any kind of industry that would use that water.
I think our plans envision that that's indeed uh-huh. what we'll try to do, is that we'll talk to the stakeholders and find out what their concerns are, and then we'll get whatever kind of expertise is needed to address it.
I may not be saying it right. The stakeholders themselves, how are they going to get this information so they'll know to become stakeholders? For example, small business and large business and
I apologize.
Municipals and recreation, how do those people get this information?
We have a list that we've tried to think expansively about who it is that ought to be apprised of the process. I can't tell you, Megan, how many are on the list right now?
Right now we have
about 230 people that we'll be bringing.
But categories. I hear you have numbers, but categories.
I think recreation, sand and gravel, certainly the river
yes.
authorities. Agriculture will play a big role because of sedimentation issues. I'm sure I'm missing some. Megan, bail me out.
We have our list. So we've had freshwater mussel work for about the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. Through that process, we've expanded out our list with more and more stakeholders that are interested in mussels. And one thing we've been trying to do since the beginning of this project is do more outreach of phone calls and reaching out to municipalities and cities. And so we'll have our first meeting about this program on the 7th, and mm-hmm. then move into monthly meetings. But we'll be really trying to do as much outreach as possible to pull as many people into that room.
I think the idea was start with 230 and then expand out and hope that word of mouth can help on a lot of it. But that's one of the things we need to discuss because, I mean, the important thing is that we get everybody that can be affected that wants to have input to give them an opportunity. I want to come back and answer your question a little bit when I said our office put together this program. We never put together a program like this in isolation. Once we've concluded that freshwater mussels is an issue that we need to deal with, we then proceed to make contact through the various people that we've dealt with, and to discuss our plans and our goals, and then ask their input about how to accomplish these things. So from the very beginning, we seek and receive a lot of scientific input. We're not scientists. I'm a scientist. We've got two or three people that are scientists, but we don't want to act in that role. What we want to do is make sure that we identify good questions to ask and good people to try to answer those questions. Yes,
The sagebrush lizard was threatened to be listed years ago, right? 2012.
Yes.
Were you involved in that?
Other than the fact that we still hold the permit, and there's seldom a day that I don't spend too many hours working on it.
But there was a conservation agreement that prevented listing, right? Is that a fair way to say what happened?
I'm wondering
if that's where we're headed. Is this information going to be used to try to work out a deal to prevent listing? And then also, what can we do to help besides going to stakeholders?
I think, first of all, when I talk about voluntary conservation measures, I think options such as the DSL, dune sagebrush lizard, will be one that will be available. I think that since that time, they've perfected some other variations of that are probably a little less complicated and a little bit easier to work with. But I think the idea is to take is to make sure, first of all, that y'all are aware of all the options that are available to you and what's entailed in those, and then give y'all a chance to discuss it. And again, it's one of those things is that if we can't answer the questions, we'll find the people that can and bring them into the process. What can you do in order to, besides attending the meeting? The meetings are not going to be meetings in which we stand up and just tell you things. I think we expect there to be a dialogue, and we're experienced, or at least we're experienced in trying to help facilitate those kinds of dialogues, so that you all begin talking to everybody, to other stakeholders, so that you all can both share information, learn from other people. You make your own decision in the end, but I think to give you the benefit of the process. But from our perspective, the controller has made it clear that, unlike with the DSL, where the controller's office somewhat dictated what the outcome would look like, we believe that Controller Hager believes that this is a stakeholder decision, and our role is to facilitate them making that decision and give the stakeholders the tools they need to be able to accomplish that.
Yeah, you're saying the process has changed a little bit. There's other options. You're in the very early stages of it. Do you give the same presentation to LCRA or Trinity River Authority? And is their response, do you get questions? Or are they fired up about it? Or what are we looking at?
Well, I don't want to characterize whether they're fired up or not, but they are enthusiastic and supportive of it, yes.
Yeah, and supportive of y'all. I mean, I'm not grilling you. I think we agree with y'all. We don't want it listed, but I'm just trying to make sure we know what we can best do to help make sure that doesn't happen. Appreciate you coming.
Well, I mean, first of all, I think that, to the extent that I don't intend to be evasive on it, but the answer is that until we get in and learn more about the science, until we understand what the impacts really are, it's hard to answer the question of where we're going to end up. You can kind of look at it. You all have three mussel species. If one of them gets listed, you've got a problem of some kind. And certainly, to the extent that it's listed because of something that's taking place over at another basin, then you've really got a problem. And that gives you an opportunity through this group to discuss it with what I'd call the major source of the problem in that latter instance, and see if we can't find some way that everybody walks out of this thing without the species being listed. So it's really an iterative process. Yes?
Yes, I would like to give you an example of a true impact that's already occurred. There's a small city that has passed a bond issue, and we're not talking a huge system, a wastewater treatment system and sewage lines and whatnot. And they're on one of the creeks in the basin. And in September, they thought that they would get all of their permits, September of 2016. They've been in the process for a number of years. And it was held up for some reason. They didn't know why. They came back and wanted some more information. So the city had to hire, of course, a consultant to do some biological assessment that time on the salamander. And now, early in January, they were notified by Fish and Wildlife that they now have to do an assessment on the mussels. Now, here's the problem. Their interest on the $10 million bond is $350 a day. So by March, they will not have enough money to build the system.
And that's the reason that our major objective needs to be to keep the species from being listed. Because if you don't achieve that, then the kind of stories you're telling will just grow and grow and grow. Let me, if I can, just take another. Can I have just a couple more minutes?
Please.
Okay. Let me try to make sure that when you ask the question about what are the potential consequences, I mean, this is, I've been in litigating Endangered Species Act cases for about 10 or 12 years, and I think I've probably seen everything bad that could happen. But the The consequences flow in from two major sources. If Fish and Wildlife Service decides to list the mussels, they're not going to pass regulations telling you what to do, okay? Instead, it flows from the fact that what's called Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act, which says that any federal action, which would include approving a permit or funding a project, has to go through consultation to make sure that the project is not jeopardizing the continued existence of the species or destroying or adversely modifying critical habitat. Okay? Now, my experience over the years is that's a negotiation. Okay? And it's a negotiation in which you don't hold a lot of cards, primarily for the kind of reasons you're talking about. Time is your biggest enemy. And if Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't get what they want, and I'm not saying it hasn't changed since November or it won't change after November, but it was always they could wait you out, okay? And they could force the changes just by being difficult to get along with. So that's Section 7, and that can cause you a lot of problems, okay? Particularly, I can imagine the number of federal approvals that you all might need for your various projects. And so that's one thing. The second thing is called Section 9. Section 9 was put into the act, and it was supposed to be the real teeth of the act. And what it basically says is that it's unlawful to take an endangered species. Now, that's a prohibition that takes place not on the species level itself, but a single member of the species. Okay? So it's meant to be a very powerful tool. The Fifth Circuit, which Texas is a part of, put restrictions on what must be proven before they can bring that case about. That's the TAPS lawsuit related to the Guadalupe River. But that's another source. And it's also a source of aggravation. I believe GBRA spent $7 million defending the TAPS lawsuit, and that's only a small part of the attorney's fees that went into it. So the consequences of listing Section 7, Section 9. Beyond that, the consequences are that one of the things that are likely to happen to you through these processes, and I'm assuming 7 is going to be the biggest obstacle because of the Fifth Circuit decision, but one of the consequences is they may want flows. They may want to regulate flows. They may want to regulate flows during drought. They may want to impose certain restrictions on water quality. Maybe that doesn't affect you, but it's certainly going to affect agriculture and a lot of your customers. Okay, so that Section 7 then becomes a vehicle in which they can impose these things. And as to the flows, you're really talking about Texas's own ability to regulate the resource, surface water, groundwater. And so that's a very significant consequence, one that has a lot of dollars associated with it, but also has a lot of just plain it didn't write associated with it. Other questions?
It's just a Texas water problem? Why aren't other states doing something?
Well, I told you that, back in fact, I was at the Justice Department during the Bush White House, and it started there, and is when the environmental groups wanted to go after acid mine drainage. So they had all the mussels listed down at the bottom of these. So it was done to achieve a purpose. And it started, as you can imagine, in West Virginia, Tennessee, and then it spread throughout the Southwest and Southeast, excuse me. And so there have been people that feel that for a long time Texas was going to be next. You can make up your own conclusions what they're after. A lot of people think they're after Texas' use of water. And reservoirs and dams. So it's not a unique problem to Texas, but right now Texas seems to be more in the crosshairs immediately. Now that's because environmental groups have filed these listing petitions. But when you have 12 species, counting the hornshell, which are due for listing decisions in the next two or three, 4 years, The state of Texas has a problem. Other questions? Yes, sir. Let me conclude with what I should have started with, and that is to thank you for the opportunity to speak. I hope that this is something that y'all are going to want to follow, take advantage of. It doesn't cost anything. We don't make you buy coffee or anything else. So we hope you'll take advantage of it. We hope you'll contribute to it, because obviously I think you have a lot to contribute to it. And so we look forward to seeing someone from BRAA there on the 7th, and we hope as the future goes out that you'll continue to attend. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor.